Chapter 8. The Four Great Reliances. Criteria for the Spiritual Life. Throughout northeastern India, where the Buddha lived and taught, there are scattered a number of places which have special associations with events in the Buddha's life. There is Bodh Gaya, where he gained enlightenment, Sarnath, where he first taught the Dharma, Shravasti, where he spent many rainy seasons and gave many teachings, and Kushinaragara, where he finally passed away between the twin sal trees. All these holy places have their own atmospheres and their own ways of commemorating the Buddha. But although they are so different, the sacred sites have one thing in common. They all have stupas. A stupa is a reliquary, a dome-shaped structure which contains, or supposedly contains, a body relic of the Buddha or one of his disciples, a tiny fragment of bone or ash. The Indian ones are made of brick faced with stone, and they are often quite enormous. In the course of the centuries, the stupas at the sacred sites have been neglected, and some have even been plundered for their materials. As late as the 18th century, for instance, bricks were taken from one of the great stupas at Sarnath to build a marketplace in the city of Varanasi. Today, many of the stupas are little more than heaps of rubble. But even those that are relatively undamaged or have been restored to some extent have a desolate, uncared-for look. After all, the archaeological department's responsibility is just to restore them, not to decorate them or make them beautiful. It is true that among the many tourists and sightseers, increasing numbers of pilgrims now visit the major sites. Even so, these places are a sad and feeble shadow of what they were 1 or 2,000 years ago. In those days, all the stupas would have been intact, and they would have been entirely covered with stone, much of it elaborately carved. Moreover, each stupa would have been beautifully decorated, with multitudes of coloured flags and banners, and all sorts of streamers, some of them made with gold or silver plates hinged together, just as one sees in Nepal even today. Each stupa would have been hung with strings of pearls and festoons of flowers. At night, one would have seen hundreds of tiny oil lamps burning in all the niches. And on the four sides of the stupa, north, south, east and west, gateways of sweet-smelling Indian flowers would have been set up. Above all, around the stupas, there would have been thousands upon thousands of pilgrims, all dressed in garments of spotless white. They would not have been aimlessly milling around, gaping at the stupa like tourists. They would have been circumambulating it, walking round and round, keeping it on their right as a sign of respect. They would have processed around it, perhaps 8 or 10 abreast, carrying in their hands trays containing all sorts of offerings, flowers, lights and lamps, sticks of lighted incense. And as they marched round and round, they would have chanted the refuges and precepts, and all sorts of devotional verses in praise of the Buddha and the great Bodhisattvas. Accompanying the chanting, there would have been the sound of drums and other musical instruments. Altogether, it must have been a truly wonderful spectacle, especially when the sun shone down on it all from a clear blue sky. This sort of observance, which was very popular with Buddhists in ancient India, is usually known as stupa worship, but this is not quite correct. The devotees were not really worshipping the structure of brick and stone, however beautiful it was. They were worshipping the body relics of the Buddha, enshrined within the stupa, and thus worshipping the Buddha. This sort of worship, known as amisa puja, or worship with material things, has of course its counterpart, with greater or lesser degrees of splendour, in all religious traditions. But in chapter 13 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, which, together with chapter 14, Thurman entitles simply Epilogue, a fundamental question arises. Is there not a better way of worshipping the Buddha? It is in the course of the answer to this question that we come across the four great reliances as criteria for the spiritual life. But although it is in chapter 13 that this question is asked directly, we get some hint of it in the previous chapter, Vision of the Universe of Abhirati and the Tathagata Akshobhya. The vision of the title is the main event of the chapter, and it comes about when Shariputra asks the Buddha in which Buddha land Vimalakirti died before being reborn in this, our world. The Buddha tells Shariputra to ask Vimalakirti himself, but Vimalakirti, perhaps predictably, is rather unhelpful, becoming very metaphysical and paradoxical. So the Buddha comes to Shariputra's rescue. He says that Vimalakirti comes from the presence of the Buddha, Akshobhya, in the universe Abhirati, and has been reborn in this Saha universe, this universe of suffering and tribulation, not as a result of his past karma, but voluntarily. He has come here to purify living beings and to make the light of wisdom shine in the midst of the darkness of the passions. Having heard this, everybody present in the great assembly wants to see Abhirati, so Vimalakirti, at the Buddha's request, shows it to them by means of his magical power. The hint we are looking for, as to a better way of worshipping the Buddha, comes in a little exchange between the Buddha and Vimalakirti at the beginning of the chapter. The Buddha asks Vimalakirti, Noble son, when you would see the Tathagata, the Buddha, how do you view him? And Vimalakirti replies, Lord, when I would see the Tathagata, I view him by not seeing any Tathagata. Why? I see him as not born from the past, not passing on to the future, and not abiding in the present time. Why? He is the essence, which is the reality of matter, but he is not matter. He is the essence, which is the reality of sensation, but he is not sensation. He is the essence, which is the reality of intellect, but he is not intellect. He is the essence, which is the reality of motivation, yet he is not motivation. He is the essence, which is the reality of consciousness, yet he is not consciousness. Like the element of space, he does not abide in any of the four elements. Transcending the scope of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, he is not produced in the six sense media. He is not involved in the three worlds, is free of the three defilements, is associated with the triple liberation, is endowed with the three knowledges, and has truly attained the unattainable. The Tathagata has reached the extreme of detachment in regard to all things, yet he is not a reality limit. He abides in ultimate reality, yet there is no relationship between it and him. He is not produced from causes, nor does he depend on conditions. He is not without any characteristic, nor has he any characteristic. He has no single nature, nor any diversity of natures. He is not a conception, not a mental construction, nor is he a non-conception. He is neither the other shore, nor this shore, nor that between. He is neither here, nor there, nor anywhere else. He is neither this, nor that. He cannot be discovered by consciousness, nor is he inherent in consciousness. He is neither darkness nor light. He is neither name nor sign. He is neither weak nor strong. He lives in no country or direction. He is neither good nor evil. He is neither compounded nor uncompounded. He cannot be explained as having any meaning whatsoever. The Tathagata is neither generosity nor avarice, neither morality nor immorality, neither tolerance nor malice, neither effort nor sloth, neither concentration nor distraction, neither wisdom nor foolishness. He is inexpressible. He is neither truth nor falsehood, neither escape from the world, nor failure to escape from the world, neither cause of involvement in the world, nor not a cause of involvement in the world. He is the cessation of all theory and all practice. He is neither a field of merit, nor not a field of merit. He is neither worthy of offerings, nor unworthy of offerings. He is not an object, and cannot be contacted. He is not a whole, nor a conglomeration. He surpasses all calculations. He is utterly unequalled, yet equal to the ultimate reality of things. He is matchless, especially in effort. He surpasses all measure. He does not go, does not stay, does not pass beyond. He is neither seen, heard, distinguished, nor known. He is without any complexity, having attained the equanimity of omniscient gnosis. Equal towards all things, he does not discriminate between them. He is without reproach, without excess, without corruption, without conception, and without intellectualization. He is without activity, without birth, without occurrence, without origin, without production, and without non-production. He is without fear and without subconsciousness, without sorrow, without joy, and without strain. No verbal teaching can express him. Such is the body of the Tathagata, and such should he be seen, and thus should he be seen. Who sees thus, truly sees. Who sees otherwise, sees falsely. In other words, the Buddha is to be identified with his spiritual essence. He is to be identified with what makes him a Buddha, with his enlightenment, with his realization of the nature of ultimate reality. So worship of the Buddha must go far beyond the worship of his body relics enshrined in a stupa. Not that stupa worship is wrong, it helps to develop devotional feeling, but the body relics are not the Buddha. The Buddha, in fact, is not to be identified with his material body at all, not even during his lifetime. So if it is good to develop devotional feelings, but worship of body relics is not enough, what should be worshipped? This is the opening theme of the next chapter of the text, chapter 13. Here we are again concerned with the question of previous incarnations, including those of the Buddha Shakyamuni himself. At the beginning of the chapter, we find Shakra, more usually known as Indra, the king of the gods, coming forward. He says that he has never before heard such a wonderful teaching as this Vimalakirti Nidesha, and he praises it at length. He also promises to protect it. From all this, incidentally, we can gather that the text is beginning to come to an end. Approving of what Shakra says, the Buddha asks him to imagine that the whole great universe is full of Buddhas, as full of Buddhas as it is of plants, bushes, grass and trees. Suppose, he says, these Buddhas passed away into Parinirvana, or, in ordinary parlance, suppose they died. And suppose somebody erected marvellous stupas for each and every one of them, stupas made entirely of precious stones, each stupa as large as a world. Suppose that devotee spent a whole aeon or more worshipping all those stupas with flowers, perfumes, and music. They would certainly gain much merit. But, the Buddha continues, if someone were to accept, recite, and understand deeply the exposition of Dharma called Instruction in the Inconceivable Emancipation, their merits would be far greater. Why? Because the enlightenment of the Buddhas arises from the Dharma. So one truly honours the Buddhas not by material offerings, but by honouring the Dharma. This may be clear enough, But how does one go about Dharma worship? What is Dharma worship? The Buddha answers this question by way of further instruction to Shakra, in the course of which he refers to events of the remote past. Once upon a time, the Buddha says, the text doesn't actually say once upon a time, but there is that sort of feeling to the story coming up. There was a Buddha called Bhayasajaraja, King of Healing, or Medicine King. He lived an inconceivably long time ago, and his lifespan was 20 short aeons. He had a retinue of 36 million billion disciples, that is, followers of the Hinayana, and also a retinue of 12 million billion bodhisattvas, or followers of the Mahayana. At the same time, there lived a universal monarch called Ratnachatra, or Precious Umbrella, or Precious Parasol, and he had 1,000 sons. This king and his sons were very devoted to the Buddha Bhayasajaraja. They all worshipped him by making many offerings of material things, and they continued to do so for 10 whole aeons. But there was one prince, the odd man out, or we might say the individual, who was not satisfied with this sort of thing. We might even go so far as to say that he was fed up with it all. His name was Chandrachatra, Lunar Umbrella or Lunar Parasol. Retiring into solitude, Chandrachatra thought to himself, is there not another mode of worship, even better and more noble than this? And he got an answer. The gods spoke to him from the sky, and they said, good man, the supreme worship is the Dharma worship. Whether or not Chandrachatra was at all taken aback by this occurrence, the text doesn't tell us, but he asks the gods what this Dharma worship might be, and they replied, go to the Tathagata Bhayasajaraja, and he will tell you. So Chandrachatra duly went to see Bhayasajaraja and put to him the same question, what is Dharma worship? And Bhayasajaraja replied, noble son, the Dharma worship is that worship rendered to the discourses taught by the Tathagata. These discourses are deep and profound in illumination. They do not conform to the mundane and are difficult to understand and difficult to see and difficult to realize. They are subtle, precise, and ultimately incomprehensible. As scriptures, they are collected in the canon of the Bodhisattvas, stamped with the insignia of the King of Incantations and Teachings. They reveal the irreversible wheel of Dharma, arising from the six transcendences, cleansed of any false notions. They are endowed with all the aids to enlightenment, and embody the seven factors of enlightenment. They introduce living beings to the great compassion and teach them the great love. They eliminate all the convictions of the Maras and they manifest relativity. They contain the message of selflessness, living beinglessness, lifelessness, personlessness, voidness, signlessness, wishlessness, non-performance, non-production, and non-occurrence. They make possible the attainment of the seat of enlightenment and set in motion the wheel of the Dharma. They are approved and praised by the chief of the gods, Nagas, Yakshas, Gandharvas, Asuras, Garudas, Kimnaras, and Maharagas. They preserve unbroken the heritage of the holy Dharma, contain the treasury of the Dharma, and represent the summit of the Dharma worship. They are upheld by all holy beings and teach all the Bodhisattva practices. They induce the unmistaken understanding of the Dharma in its ultimate sense. They certify that all things are impermanent, miserable, selfless, and peaceful, thus epitomizing the Dharma. They caused the abandonment of avarice, immorality, malice, laziness, forgetfulness, foolishness, and jealousy, as well as bad convictions, adherence to objects, and all opposition. They are praised by all the Buddhas. They are medicines for the tendencies of mundane life, and they authentically manifest the great happiness of liberation. To teach correctly, to uphold, to investigate, and to understand such scriptures, thus incorporating into one's own life the holy Dharma, that is the Dharma worship. Furthermore, noble son, the Dharma worship consists of determining the Dharma according to the Dharma, applying the Dharma according to the Dharma, being in harmony with relativity, being free of extremist convictions, attaining the tolerance of ultimate birthlessness and non-occurrence of all things, realizing selflessness and living beinglessness, refraining from struggle about causes and conditions without quarrelling or disputing, not being possessive, being free of egoism, relying on the meaning and not the literal expression, relying on gnosis and not on consciousness, relying on the ultimate teachings, definitive in meaning, and not insisting on the superficial teachings, interpretable in meaning, relying on reality and not insisting on opinions derived from personal authorities, realizing correctly the reality of the Buddha, realizing the ultimate absence of any fundamental consciousness, and overcoming the habit of clinging to an ultimate ground. Finally, attaining peace by stopping everything from ignorance to old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, misery, anxiety and trouble, and realizing that living beings know no end to their views concerning these 12 links of dependent origination. Then, noble son, when you do not hold to any view at all, it is called the unexcelled Dharma worship. So this is Bhāsacharaja's explanation of Dharma worship. And when Chandrachatra heard it, he was overwhelmed by a profound transcendental experience. Vowing to devote himself to the Dharma and to attain supreme enlightenment, without delay he went forth from home into the homeless life. Having told the story, the Buddha proceeds to identify the characters in it for Chakra's benefit. He says that King Ratnachakra was none other than the Buddha Ratnakis, as he afterwards became, and his 1,000 sons are the 1,000 bodhisattvas of the present aeon. And Prince Chandrachatra was the Buddha Shakyamuni himself in a previous life. So, as this story shows, there is a better way of worshipping the Buddha than by making offerings of material things, and it is known as Dharma worship. And the first thing that Bhāsacharaja mentions as constituting Dharma worship is determining the Dharma according to the Dharma, applying the Dharma according to the Dharma, or, as Lamotte translates it, understanding the law according to the law. Determining the Dharma according to the Dharma implies not determining the Dharma in terms of that which is not the Dharma. For us in the West, this means not trying to understand the Dharma, whether consciously, unconsciously, or semi-consciously, in accordance with Christian beliefs, or modern secularist, humanist, rationalist, or scientific modes of thought, or New Age philosophies. The Dharma is to be determined and understood in accordance with the Dharma. To determine it, or understand it in accordance with anything else, is to falsify it, distort it, and betray it. In the same way, Dharma worship consists of applying the Dharma according to the Dharma. If you try to break off a bit of the Dharma to take some Buddhist teaching and apply it according to, say, Christian ideas, it just won't work, That is, it won't work as the Dharma. There is no such thing as Christian Zen, for example. The Dharma is to be applied according to the Dharma. Nowadays we hear a great deal of talk about the spiritual life, about growth, about personal development, even about meditation. But these terms are often used rather vaguely and superficially. Few people have a clear idea of what they really mean. And if you don't know what such terms mean, you lay yourself open to what can only be called exploitation. If someone comes along from the East, or even more likely from California, and they set up their spiritual shop advertising this or that technique of personal development, this or that brand of meditation, or even some quite bizarre teaching and charging quite a lot of money, it seems there is no way of knowing clearly what you would be letting yourself in for if you got involved with them. Without clear criteria to apply, you may get involved with a reasonably positive group, or you may get psychologically damaged by a cynical racket, but you won't be able to make real spiritual progress. If you have no criteria to apply, you have no way of telling. So we need criteria for the spiritual life, and such criteria we find in the four great reliances which Bhāsajīraja cites in the Vimukirti Nidesha. The word reliance here translates the Sanskrit term pratisarana. Sarana means refuge, and prati is a preposition meaning, in this context, something like about or connected with. When you rely on something or someone, you entrust yourself to it or to them. You take refuge in it or in them. Pratisarana is probably a little stronger in meaning than our word reliance, so it is appropriate to call them the four great reliances, and this also serves to emphasize their intrinsic importance. Thurman translates the reliances in the following way. 1. Relying on the meaning and not the literal expression. 2. Relying on gnosis and not on consciousness. 3. Relying on the ultimate teachings definitive in meaning and not insisting on the superficial teachings interpretable in meaning. 4. Relying on reality and not insisting on opinions derived from personal authorities. These four great reliances are not unique to this text, but are to be encountered in many others. For some reason or other, in the Vimukirti Nidesha, they are not enumerated in the usual order, but we will look at them in the order in which they are usually presented, because this makes them rather more intelligible. I will also change the translation somewhat. Thurman's translation paraphrases a little, and I will put the reliances in the more usual preceptive or admonitionary form. Thus we get 1. One should rely on the Dharma, not on any person. 2. One should rely on the meaning, not the expression. 3. One should rely on the discourses of explicit meaning, not on the discourses of implicit meaning. 4. One should rely on transcendental awareness, not on discriminative consciousness. 1. One should rely on the Dharma, not on any person. The word for person used in this first reliance is putgala, which could also be rendered individual. Dharma, of course, means the teaching of the Buddha. So, one should rely on the teaching of the Buddha, not on any individual. At first sight, this is a rather strong statement. Does it mean that one should not rely upon one's teachers or spiritual friends? Is it advocating that we should simply read books about Buddhism without having any contact with Buddhists, as some people in fact do? Certainly not. What this reliance is really getting at is that one should rely on someone only to the extent that they embody the Dharma, not represent it or symbolize it, but embody it. The Dharma does not exist in the abstract. There is no such thing as friendliness. There are only friendly people. There is no such thing as joy. There are only joyful people. There is no such thing as meditation. There are only people who meditate. There is no such thing as wisdom. There are only people who are wise. We could even say that there is no such thing as enlightenment, but only people who are enlightened. An abstract Dharma is a non-existent Dharma. The Dharma does not really exist in the sutras. It does not really exist in books. It exists only to the extent that it is practiced and realized in the lives of individual human beings. So relying on the Dharma, not on any person, does not mean abandoning the living Dharma, the Dharma as actually realized by individuals, for the sake of the dead Dharma, the words of the Dharma as preserved in books. We are not being advised to give up on the spiritual community and shut ourselves up in the library, or to be self-sufficient in an individualistic way. Still less should we take this as a directive to rely on our own limited subjective understanding of the words of the scriptures. What it does mean, in a word, is that we should not rely on authority. But what is authority? First, a distinction needs to be drawn between natural authority and artificial authority. An appreciation of spiritual hierarchy, a reverence for those more developed than oneself, is crucial to a healthy spiritual life, and this we could call a response to natural authority. It is artificial authority, spiritual triumphalism, upon which we should never rely. Let's return to the example of the mystic guru. Suppose some new spiritual teacher is expected in town, perhaps from the East, or mystic Tibet, exotic Japan, or maybe from mysterious India, or indeed from California. Before he or she arrives, posters and leaflets are plastered all over town. You hear, usually from some devotee speaking with bated breath, that this is a very great teacher indeed, a very great guru. In fact, the rumour is that he is enlightened. Depending on the tradition to which he belongs, you may be told that he is an incarnation of God, the incarnation of God, or just plain God. Or you may be told that he is the umpteenth reincarnation of some great spiritual personality of the past, or the head of a huge organisation with thousands, even millions of followers, who are in possession of all sorts of wonderful, esoteric spiritual secrets. Eventually, the great guru arrives, and a big meeting is organized to receive him. You don't get anywhere near him, of course, although you may catch a glimpse of him from a distance. Then you see him sitting up at the front of the hall, on a throne, or surrounded by a halo of electric light bulbs. Next, you hear what he has to say. It is pretty platitudinous, but you are terribly impressed. You believe every word, accept every word, hang upon every word. After all, you have been told that this is an enlightened master, or even God, speaking. After a few days, he flies on to the next capital city and another big reception. And in his wake, a local group is started, advertising his particular technique of personal development, or meditation, and you enroll yourself as a disciple, all on the strength of an illusion. This is perhaps rather an exaggerated story, but it is not exaggerated very much. Such things have happened, and they will keep on happening as long as people continue to rely on a person, not on the Dharma. This is not at all to suggest that there are no genuine spiritual teachers coming to the West, and those who do come should be given proper respect. But real spiritual teachers do not make claims about themselves, and they do not allow claims to be made on their behalf. They are not out to impress, they are not after power. Anybody who does make such extravagant claims is not a spiritual teacher, but a politician. This needs to be stated strongly, because in some quarters there are signs that the great Eastern spiritual traditions are being turned into nothing less than a racket, signs that people are being exploited because they are insecure, because they want to be told what to do by some authority figure. This first reliance comes, therefore, as a timely warning. One should rely not on claims, not on authority, not on power, but on the Dharma. The Dharma as actually embodied in the lives of spiritual friends with whom one is in real contact and communication. It is spiritual friendship that helps us to practice the Dharma, not glamorous but distant spiritual superstars. This emphasis on contact with the living Dharma, with people who are practicing Buddhism, does not mean that we can forget all about the study of the Dharma as presented in the scriptures. The scriptures are the record of the spiritual experiences, insights, discoveries and realizations of the Buddha and his disciples down the ages, and studying them is a tremendously valuable source of inspiration. But the scriptures are best studied with the help and companionship of spiritual friends. By virtue of their own spiritual experience, they will be able to bring the words of the scriptures to life. They will, as Bhāsajaraja puts it, determine the Dharma according to the Dharma. That is, they will explain the Dharma according to the Dharma, not according to preconceived ideas that have nothing to do with the Dharma, or according to their own subjective emotional states. 2. One should rely on the meaning, not on the expression. The second of the four great reliances is advising us to rely on the meaning, not on the expression. In other words, whether we are considering the scriptures themselves or what our spiritual friends have to say about the scriptures, we need to make sure that we are being sensitive to the spirit, not just the letter, of what is being said. The word translated as meaning is artha, but the words rendered as expression, vijnana, is rather more difficult to explain. In this context, it means something like a manifestation or expression of meaning in words. Such an expression can never be more than approximate. In fact, it demonstrates that words have their limitations, even though within those limitations, they can usually do far more than we think they can. We don't find Shakespeare, for instance, complaining about the limitations of language, even though he had more to express than most people. Nonetheless, we cannot understand what someone is saying, or even what the Buddha is saying, if we pay more attention to the way they are talking than to what they are trying to say. This often crops up in the course of ordinary communication. You may be trying to tell somebody something, but you find, at first to your surprise, and eventually to your annoyance, that they keep picking you up on phrases, figures of speech, even individual words, in a quite unreasonable way. In the end, it dawns on you that they are trying to trip you up with words, because they don't really want to understand what you are trying to say. They don't really want to communicate, so they are listening to your expression, not your meaning. Communication is possible only on the basis of openness and receptivity. This means really wanting to understand what the other person is trying to say. The important thing is to pay attention to them, to be aware of them, because the meaning is, after all, their meaning. So, one should rely on the meaning, not on the expression, on the spirit, not on the letter. This applies to ordinary day-to-day communication, to one's communication with one's spiritual friends, and also to one's study of the scriptures. One should rely on the meaning of the Dharma, not on its expression in words and phrases. Otherwise, one is in danger of becoming a mere scholar of Buddhism, someone who may have the letter of the Dharma at their fingertips, but who does not come within a million miles of its spirit. 3. One should rely on the discourses of explicit meaning, not on the discourses of implicit meaning. With this third reliance, we become just a little technical. Discourses translates the words the word sutras, that is, discourses delivered by the Buddha, discourses on the Dharma. It is these discourses, of course, which make up the greater part of the Buddhist scriptures. They are very numerous. They are traditionally said to comprise 84,000 Dharma skandhas, or categories of teachings, and they are also very varied in form, in content, and in other ways. In some cases their meaning is quite obvious, in others some interpretation is needed. We can get an idea of this distinction from two simple examples from the Dhammapada. Verse 5 of the Dhammapada says, "Enmity does not cease by enmity at any time. It ceases only by non-enmity." This is sometimes translated, "Hatred never ceases by hatred. It ceases only by love." Now, the meaning of this verse is quite clear. It would seem to need no interpretation, because it does not seem open to any misunderstanding. It would not be possible, for instance, to interpret the verse as meaning that enmity does cease by means of enmity. One could not interpret it as meaning that violence or war is justified, or that there could be a war to end all wars. The meaning of the verse is quite unambiguous. It means exactly what it says. But another verse from the Dhammapada, verse 294, says, "Having killed mother and father, the Brahmana goes blameless." What about this verse? Does it mean what it says? Well, it is clear enough what it seems to mean, but we can hardly leave it at that. It needs interpretation, and this is what, elsewhere, the Buddha himself gives. He says that mother is craving and father is ignorance. They are called mother and father because they are the root of samsara, the root of conditioned existence. To cut this root is to put an end to samsara. That is why one who kills mother and father goes blameless. So here we have two kinds of discourse, those that do not require any interpretation and those that do. Discourses of explicit meaning, as they're called, and discourses of implicit meaning. The Sanskrit is nitartha and nayartha, or nitartha and anitartha. It is important to be clear about this distinction, and the third, great reliance, depends upon it. One should rely on the discourses of explicit meaning, not on the discourses of implicit meaning, because the meaning of the former is clear, obvious, and unambiguous, needing no interpretation. Not only that, discourses of implicit meaning should be interpreted in accordance with discourses of explicit meaning. The discourses of explicit meaning, in other words, represent or embody the criterion. Your interpretations can be as fanciful and far-fetched as you like. You can bring out all sorts of strange, unexpected, and outlandish ideas from sutras of implicit meaning. This is perfectly legitimate and valid. But what you bring out must not contradict the discourses of explicit meaning. We can apply this principle to the Vimalakirti Nirdesha itself. How do the passages in it that deal with all sorts of magical events stand in relation to this third great reliance? There are two points to be made. Firstly, the meaning of these passages is not rational or scientific, but poetic, imaginative, mythic. As such, it makes its own non-rational appeal. The distinction between explicit meaning and implicit meaning applies mainly to discourses of a more discursive nature. But secondly, if these passages are interpreted or translated, so to speak, from the poetic to the rational mode of expression, then the rational expression must not contradict the discourses of explicit meaning. 4. One should rely on transcendental awareness, not on discriminative awareness. The Sanskrit words used in this fourth great reliance, jnana and vijnana, are both derived from the root jna, to know. Jnana is pure knowledge, pure awareness, knowledge without any subject or object. It is knowledge which does not know anything and does not belong to anybody. I have therefore rendered it transcendental awareness. It is what Gampopa, describing the Dharmakaya, calls the pure non-dual shine. Vijnana is divided knowledge, divided awareness, knowledge which is divided between subject and object, whether it is between sense organs and sense objects, or between mind and mental objects, or between ego, self and world. It is knowledge which takes place within the subject-object framework, and which is therefore limited, or even distorted, by that framework. I have therefore rendered vijnana as discriminative consciousness. The Depth Psychology of the Yogacara enumerates 8 vijnanas, the 5 sense consciousnesses, the mind consciousness, mano vijnana, the soiled mind consciousness, klisto mano vijnana, and the relative store consciousness, alia vijnana. The work of the spiritual life is to transform these 8 vijnanas, these 8 discriminative consciousnesses, into the 5 jnanas, the 5 transcendental awarenesses or wisdoms, which are symbolized by the 5 Buddhas of the mandala. There are the Buddhas of the 4 directions: Amoghasiddhi, the all-accomplishing wisdom; Akshobhya, the mirror-like wisdom; Ratnasambhava, the wisdom of equality or sameness; and Amitabha, the all-distinguishing wisdom. And the wisdoms of these 4 Buddhas are all aspects of the wisdom of the Dharmadhatu, which sees the entire universe as fully pervaded by, or as manifesting, reality. This 5th jnana is symbolized by Virochana, the Buddha of the center of the mandala. But all this is rather technical. The main point is that the Dharma can be truly, deeply understood only by means of transcendental awareness. It cannot be understood by means of discriminative consciousness. We should therefore rely on transcendental awareness. But that is easier said than done. Before we can rely on transcendental awareness, we must have transcendental awareness. And if we don't have it, we must develop it by one means or another. And one of the means by which a transcendental awareness can be awakened is through the study and exploration of a strange and magical text like the Vimalakirti Nidesha. Our explorations here have been, of course, very far from adding up to a complete and systematic exposition of the text. We have looked at only a few of the hundreds of possible themes, taken only a few drops from the ocean. It remains for us to plunge into the ocean itself, the ocean of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, the ocean of the inconceivable emancipation. The end.